I know many farmers that have had a great year. They've used zero chemical inputs, and I think therefore it's clearly possible.
Joel Williams is an independent plant and soil health educator working on soil management, plant nutrition, and integrated approaches of sustainable food production. Joel's interested in designing farming systems that focus on managing soil biology, along with crop and soil nutrition to optimize plant immunity and soil function. He has extensive experience working in Australia, the UK, and Canada, where he's currently based. At Soils for Life, we've recently launched a major project focused on cropping systems, and we thought Joel would be the perfect person to talk about why and how growers are transitioning to a more regenerative, resilient approach to cropping. If you have any feedback or questions about this podcast, or suggestions of topics or people you'd like us to include in future episodes, please reach out on social media or via info@soilsforlife.org.au. So Joel, if you could first just tell us a little bit about the types of enterprises you currently work with.
Sure. It's a bit of a mixed bag. Although I had a bit more of a background when I used to live in Australia, I used to work a bit more in the horticultural world. I was a bit more active in that space. But when I moved to the UK, that's where I started to know through necessarily any intentional design, but that's where I started working more with, you know, cropping, you know, cereals and pulses and, you know, what Australians would call broadacre, of course. I live in Canada, of course, but I still do lots of work over in Europe. So I work with farmers really in Europe, Canada and Australia. I'd say those are probably the three areas that I do a lot of my work, and then also work with more farmers in those spaces. But that said, I've dealt with some smaller vegetable farmers. I've done a bit of grazing, you know, for some beef producers and whatnot locally here in Canada too.
And what are some of the reasons that you find growers will tend to approach you for support?
I think probably one of the most common ones for sure is this interest to use less inputs, you know, reduce inputs, reduce that dependency on inputs. I think that's probably, you know, looking for, and therefore farmers are looking for cost savings, obviously. So improving the profitability side of the business that then comes from that. But I think that's probably the most common area that I seem to get engaged with. Or farmers generally just, you know, wanting to learn more about their soils and therefore how to improve them.
Yeah. So when you do get someone coming to you as a new client, like, where do you start? What sort of questions do you ask? What sorts of inquiries do you tend to make when you begin with a new farmer client?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think it's pretty much you're just trying to glean a little bit about their operation. How do they currently manage things? What are the types of inputs they use currently? What's their input program like? What kind of, obviously, tools and machinery do they use for that? So what are the options? So I like to kind of really get a picture for how they currently do things. And I feel that that really gives me that then the foundation, that platform that then I look for, okay, well, here's the opportunities to tweak that. And I think that those incremental steps are still very, very important. You know, it's still very valuable on that journey of change. I think they still bring a lot of value in terms of lower risk. And I think, you know, farming is already a risky enough, you know, business with the challenges of the weather and, you know, commodity prices and the way the market forces can respond or change so rapidly. It's a very difficult industry, I think, for farmers to be in. In this, we're lucky that I think that they're all very passionate about what they do. They love what they do because, let's be honest, some of the challenges that they face are very, very difficult. And so I think that therefore minimizing some of the risk of the transition to that business, I think, is very important. And that's kind of why then I look for those smaller kind of incremental changes on that larger journey.
What do you find your goals tend to be at that early stage when you're working with the grower? So if you are looking for those tweaks or those incremental improvements, what are the early outcomes you're trying to achieve? What does success look like for you in the early stages of working with someone?
Yeah, sure. And I guess the answer to that is a little bit dependent on what the client is maybe wanting equally, what area they want help on. So we've used this example a few times already, but on this example of reducing inputs, Okay, that's where I'd want to find out. Okay, well, what are you currently using and doing? And then what's going to be our pathway for dialing those inputs down? So in that sense, I often would use a more kind of risk-averse strategy of saying, well, look, you could go cold turkey and drop your inputs, but I probably wouldn't recommend that. Let's just dial it down slowly, step by step, over a period of a few years. So in that example, sure, I'd say that, and it could be as small as, let's just say, a 10% reduction per annum. It could just be a small. So, but that early sign of success would be, okay, in year one, and generally I find that any farmer that, from my experience anyway, that cuts their inputs by 10%, they, by the end of that first year, they see no difference. And they're like, okay, well, I know it was only a small step, but I haven't reduced yield by 10% by cutting inputs down. So I think in that early first year, we're looking for, okay, did we get used to working with each other? Were you able to implement some of the recommendations successfully? Was it practically feasible for you? What kind of an input reduction did we get? And then, how did that impact on the yield or, of course, and or the profitability?
Your organization is called Integrated Soils. Our organization, Soils for Life, we know healthy soil's the foundation of a healthy farm, but it's so incredibly diverse and complex. What do you think when you think of healthy soil? What does that actually mean to you in an agricultural context?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's why some people don't like the term soil health, because it can be a little subjective, and context dependent. It's different on what we demand of our soils. And like, of course, a healthy soil for nature conservation is going to be very different from a healthy soil for production. So there's that element of context specificity there. And I think that the easiest way to answer this question is to acknowledge that there is no single metric. There is no magic number or single variable that is going to kind of define soil as healthy or not. There's many parts to what describes a functioning soil, a healthy functioning soil. So I think there's that word there, function. I think you'd have to start by saying, well, the soil needs to perform the function that we're asking of it in that sense to produce pastures or crops, whatever the context may be there. So is it performing that function? And I think that's an important part of that definition of healthy soils. And so underneath that, however, underneath that kind of broader idea is that, okay, well, then we try and piece together pieces of a puzzle that help us to find the inner workings of that soil, which may then influence that overall function of it. And so, the general idea there would be to break down the soil into its component parts, its soil chemistry, its soil physics, its soil biology. And underneath those kind of three aspects of soil, are there things there that we can monitor, that we can manage, that we can work on improving? And so that those three parts of the soil come, the three kind of those three properties, chemistry, physics, and biology, they all must again integrate. They all work collaboratively, work together, ultimately to then influence the overall health and or function of that soil. So there's no magic thing. It's about really, that's what some of the kind of the soil health tests have done in these modern times. They've tried to integrate many pieces of many variables to try and get this overall picture. So, not just looking at the nutrient availability, not just looking at pH, but bringing some of those things and also looking at, again, some of the biological parameters, maybe earthworm counts, CO2 evolution, some of these other things that we could try and measure. And then, of course, things like soil structure or infiltration, aggregation. And so we try to piece these together into a practical way to try and then say, okay, well, this is how we're going to manage and measure and manage that soil health. So I think that that's kind of the tangible way in which we, on a day-to-day level, strive to improve those metrics. But I think the key take-home message is that there's not one of those that's the most important, and it's really about how they all be a piece of that puzzle that ultimately drives the function of that soil.
Yeah. Something that's actually struck me as I've become more exposed to some of the tests and monitoring of soil health that is available is just the incredible complexity and variability and variety of different things to look at. And so I think one of the challenges that seems to confront a lot of farmers is where to even start when looking at some of these tests. And it does seem to be a little bit more of an art, or maybe halfway between an art and a science, because of how many different variables there are, how many different properties there are that may be having an influence on the way that the soil's performing.
Yeah, that's right. Look, I agree with you. I do think it is a very complex process to navigate, and that nature of soils themselves. They are very complex ecosystems, and when they're operating it, as you pointed out, at such with such variability at a whole range of spatial scales, they can be incredibly variable down from that micro scale, then of course up to the field scale, and then broader up onwards to the landscape scale. Across all three of those scales, they can be highly, highly variable. One of the things to be mindful of, however, is just because this ecosystem, just because soils are so very complex, doesn't necessarily mean that their management has to be. And I think that, you know, and that's a good example of the soil health principles or the conservation agriculture principles. That's why I think those principles are so excellent. And I'm, you know, happy to see that they've become very well known and talked about and adopted by farmers all around the world these days, is that really those high level kind of soil health principles, they cut through all of that complexity and just say, well, look, there are a million and one specific interactions between this, that, or the other that we could worry about and we could dive into and measure and monitor, et cetera, et cetera. And we can do that. And we may need to do that in certain instances, but we can also step back from that complexity and just say, well, look, also, if you're following these macro principles as best as you can, applying them as best you can to your context, when you do that, generally, we'd find that a lot of those specific things that you're kind of pinpointing there, it's generally good for them. You know, you're generally going to improve a lot of those variables when you're operating at that kind of macro level. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about those soil health principles, for example.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. So that's a good segue to get in a bit more into the detail of how farmers can actually build healthy soils. I mean, we're always very cautious about recommending specific practices at Soils for Life. We know that the right practice, as you've said, is so highly dependent on the context. But are there practices that you find are often high on the priority list once you've worked through your initial contacts gathering, particularly thinking about your cropping clients?
Yeah, sure. And I think, again, my last answer would be a little bit still relevant for this question too. You know, sure, let's try and get some of the foundationals right. Let's try and look at those kind of soil health principles and make sure that we're applying those and optimizing those as best as possible. So I think that's always a good starting point. I think that they are foundational and we definitely have to start there. And then beyond that, sure, I think that for me personally, for listeners that probably have listened to me before and know me well, that they'd know that I'm a big promoter of carbon-based fertilizers or carbon-based inputs. And that really is, I think, again, one of those low-hanging fruit that's a really easy practice that can be integrated. And really that refers to just, it doesn't really matter what inputs you're using, what fertilizer, what pesticide inputs, but when you just add some carbon sources to them, you can improve them in many different kind of ways. And when I say carbon sources, I'm talking about things like just molasses or kelp, seaweed type extracts, fish hydrolysate type things, humic fulvic acids, these types of things. And what they can help with is just, they provide a carbon sponge, I often call it, and that just kind of binds to the nutrients or binds to those pesticides, and it can stabilize them, prevent some of the losses, improve the uptake or improve the efficiency of. There's various kind of ins and outs to that. So I think that the beautiful thing about that particular practice is that, again, it doesn't really matter what program a farmer is using. We don't even necessarily have to change that program at all. You're just going to do what you currently do already, but just add carbon. And normally when they do that, again, to this question, to also the earlier question and discussion we had about dialing down inputs, reducing inputs, that's then a great way to do that. So you can add some carbon to stabilize those inputs, but and that's a really great way to then start that process of dialing down the that 10% or whatever it is that you might be reducing, or sometimes more. So I think that something like that is a real low-hanging fruit. And really easy for anybody to integrate. I am also a big fan of liquid systems, and I think that Australia would be one of the countries who's probably a bit more leading in this department anyway, but a little less so in other parts of the world. But I do think that having liquid systems brings a lot of options for flexibility and adaptability. You can be a lot more kind of targeted and precise with your kind of recipes and nutrient mixes and that kind of thing. So it brings a real value in my mind, having the opportunity to do like a liquid inject type setup as compared to solely just granular fertilizer inputs as an example. So I think those would be kind of a couple of the ones. And you know, beyond there, you can move into some of the less, you know, starting point ones. You know, I for example, you know, we don't necessarily have to have this discussion now, but you know, things like biofertilizers or microbial products, these types of things. Like, yes, I also work with these types of products, and yes, have had many farmers use them with, of course, mixed success. They sometimes can be outstanding and sometimes less so, and that's the nature of a biological product. When it's a living organism, its response is always going to be different, depending on the environment in which it gets introduced into. So although I think those are interesting too, they would be kind of down the line strategies that would come later. We would start more at that kind of foundational level. And for those farmers that may be more inclined and interested to use some of the biofertilizers, then they can do that down the line.
Yeah, I'm aware that we skipped a little over the soil health principles, which you mentioned earlier. And just for listeners who might not have come across that set of principles, could you just at a high level talk a bit about what they are and how they fit in? We sort of jumped straight from goals and outcomes to practices. But yeah, if you could just talk a little bit about those principles.
Sure. So classically, there's five of them. Sometimes we add a sixth one on recently, but you know, the five there would be to minimize soil disturbance. And of course, that would be, I think, a common one already in the Australian context. You know, no-till and zero-till type practices are already well adopted in an Australian context. So I think we tick that box very well already. And then the other principles really are, again, really addressing, I think, some of the complexity, those specific variables that we were talking about earlier. So keeping that soil covered and with soil armor, you know, crop residue, for example. But we have the other principle that kind of extends and overlaps a lot with that one, is that trying to keep the soil covered with green plants. So a living root is often how it's phrased. So keeping a living root in the ground for as many days as possible as you possibly can. And so that's really giving us the difference between kind of brown cover, when we'd call stubble retention, et cetera, versus green cover or living cover, where we actually have living plants providing that cover. And I know that that's a practice that's also one that is a bit more challenging in the Australian context because of the such low rainfall, of course, where moisture is such a limiting factor in our context, that it's one of those principles that can definitely be done in an Australian context, but I think it needs, you know, a bit more refining and fine-tuning and just working at how to optimize that without starting to deplete soil moisture, which is of course needed for the main cash crops. So that's the one I think that we definitely need to work on, but has a lot of opportunity to really address some of those soil health changes. It's really the living roots and those root exudates that come from those living roots that really drive a lot of those changes that we talked about earlier in the chemistry, in the physics, in the biology. I think it's particularly the living roots one that is a key one. And then the last principle is integrating livestock where possible. So that's the kind of the five macro level principles: minimize disturbance, Oh, is that, did I miss one off? Keep the soil covered with armor, living room. Oh, and diversity. Okay, I need to do four. Yeah, okay, so I forgot diversity. And so that just means trying to maximize a bit of plant species diversity. Well, it could also extend to livestock diversity, of course, as well. That could be diversity through time as wider rotations, or diversity, spatial or genetic diversity. So things like companion or intercropping, or using variety blends, so mixed genetics within the one field. So those kind of macro principles, I think, are great starting points at the end that really everybody should be trying to apply those as best they can within their context at a foundational level.
Great. Just coming back to the practices, as you said, many Australian croppers are already becoming interested in biological inputs. And I've heard you talk in particular about seed treatments. As I understand, seeds have their own microbiome living in the seed and around the immediate area around the seed. I'm told that's called the spermosphere. If you could just describe that environment and why it's so important for crop growers.
Sure. Yeah, it turns out that plants intentionally have, it's mainly back when we talk about the kind of the seed biome and the plant microbiome as a whole, the above ground part anyway, it's usually dominated by bacteria. There are some others that form part of that about the above ground microbiome. Fungi would be another one, viruses, of course, but it's predominantly generally bacteria would be the main player here. And really, there are bacteria and other microbes, as I say, but mostly bacteria. They can live on the seed or inside that seed. And some of them are actually living inside the plant. They can be living inside the leaves or the stems. And when the plant is producing that seed, those microbes actually get sent up into the seed, or they migrate up into the seed where they will grow there with that seed and then go dormant. And they'll be there ready and waiting along with that dormant seed, waiting for to be planted and waiting for those conditions to break that dormancy and then grow. So seeds get their microbiome from the mother plant. So it's an intergeneration, it's handed down through the generations. And that next generation will also grow, and it will put those very same kind of species of bacteria, et cetera, again into the next generation seed as well. And it turns out really that, yes, when the seed is planted and begins to germinate, it's the seed microbiome, the organisms inside that seed, that actually start growing first. They play a very important role in facilitating the process of germination. And once that plant has germinated and the root emerges, it's those organisms that come from the seed that are very important to help the organisms from the soil microbiome, to help those organisms then colonize that plant and colonize the emerging root. And so they are the ones that kind of, the seed microbiome are the ones that kind of set the table, they set the stage for then the soil biome to then grow all over that root system and form what we also call the rhizosphere, that below ground community there around the root system. So the seed biome does very important things in terms of supporting germination and helping that plant then form its kind of intimate connection there with all of the rest of the biome in the soil. And yeah, it's obviously a very important thing that then that next generation will repeat that process and put those organisms back into the seed then for the next generation as well. So that's kind of then where some farmers these days are starting to use a lot of seed treatments to supply some of this kind of beneficial biology around that seed. And, coming back to your question earlier about some of the starting practices or some of the low-hanging fruit, I mentioned kind of carbon-based fertilizers. I would say that something like seed treatment would be another one on that list, because you're using very small amounts of inputs, but of course they're very highly targeted in the placement of those. So you're placing them right there on and around that seed so that you are very efficient with the placement, and therefore there's an efficiency gain there. You only need very, very small amounts, can kind of go a long way. So you get, good bang for your buck, so to speak. And so that's an opportunity therefore in this debate that some people have about using biofertilizers, and that they can be a bit variable because of the environmental conditions in which we introduce them. It seems to be that the seed treatment, putting them on the seed, is really a much more effective way to apply those organisms as compared to trying to wash them down into the soil or apply them to the soil per se or change the soil microbiome. Really what these are really more so trying to do is just to grow with that plant, maybe change the rhizosphere, change the plant microbiome, not necessarily drive major changes in the native soil biology, but just to change the balance of organisms that are growing around that plant in that particular season.
I've heard you talk about another similar opportunity for very targeted application of small amounts of inputs in terms of foliar sprays. And I think a few of us have been struck by the rule of thumb that you have talked about with using biological inputs on the seed and nutritional inputs in foliar sprays. So could you just talk a little bit about, you know, why in your experience those approaches generally work best, why you've sort of landed on that general rule of thumb?
Yeah, sure. And like I say, you know, rules are made to be broken sometimes too. So I think there's plenty of good reasons when that rule of thumb does not apply as well. And I'm very open to those other strategies. But I think it's a good guide, particularly when someone's starting out. And yeah, so that the rationale there really is that, yes, you can put nutrients on as a seed treatment, and this would be very common, and many farmers have done this for many, many years too. Things like trace elements, for example, manganese or zinc or something like that, you can put these on as a seed treatment. But, you know, the quantity that you can put on is so small. It's such a, and that's not to say it's useless or, you know, worthless or a waste of time. There's only a very small amount of actual nutrients that you can put on. So it can really help. It can help with establishment, gets the plant growing, gets them out of the ground. And that can be fantastic. There's nothing wrong with that. That could be job done. But I think that the difference there is that when we then talk about biology, well, putting a biofertilizer on that seed, those organisms will actually then multiply and they'll grow with that root, and that root will, you know, feed them through those root exudates. So you have that opportunity then for those organisms for the effect of those organisms to be more sustained through the whole growing season, provided that the plant is feeding them and activating them, recruiting them, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's kind of the rationale there. It's not to say I'm opposed to putting nutrients down on the seed. And indeed, normally when farmers put even biofertilizers on the seed, they're normally adding a few other nutritive type things anyway. They might put some kelp or seaweed or fish, and you're going to have a bit of nutrition there anyway. So there is some, you know, a bit of nutrients going there. It's a package anyway. But then conversely, in terms of the foliar spray, yeah, and again, I know many people have success with applying biofertilizers on the foliage, but I think this is not, it wouldn't be my starting point. I would really be much more focused on saying, I want to try and use foliar sprays to deliver nutrients. Those essential nutrients can be absorbed by that leaf, and those nutrients are then used to help plant growth, of course, but particularly to prime photosynthesis. And when you're priming photosynthesis, that means you're going to be producing more sugar through that photosynthetic process, which can then be used as a root exudate to then feed that biology. And so I think that there's a lot more challenges with some of the foliar applications of microbials. There's more points where things can go wrong with pump pressure, filtration, high UV light, like all of these things can make the foliar applications of biofertilizers more challenging. And so I think that the safer and easier option is therefore nutrients. Whereas I think on the seed, then you're putting those organisms down in the soil, where also where they're a bit more protected. And I think that it's just, that's my general rule of thumb. But like I said, I know people do slightly different things to that, but I think that that's a good general starting point.
Yeah, and it sounds like part of the reason that those are useful rules of thumb to be used cautiously, obviously, is that they might be the approaches that are least likely in lots of cases for something to go wrong. And just similar to the earlier conversation we were having about soil testing and soil monitoring, where there are just so many complexities and nuances, as I understand, there the same applies to the design of seed biological treatments and foliar sprays. The design can often be complex and nuanced, and you know what you spray, how and when you spray it can be the determining factor as to whether it works or not. And that seems like that might be quite intimidating to someone approaching the use of some of these things for the first time. So a rule of thumb that says, well, these approaches tend to be the approaches that are least likely to have something going wrong, sounds like a sensible thing to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly, yeah, a very good summary of the thinking. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I might just shift a little bit, and we've already maybe touched on this a little bit, but we know that any sort of change can be difficult, can be hard. Transitioning to a more quote-unquote regenerative approach to cropping, whatever you might like to call that, can sometimes be a bumpy road. In your experience, what are some of the common mistakes or challenges, we might also call them learning opportunities, that farmers face when they're starting out?
Yes, sure. I like the way you frame that, because I think you're right in saying that they are learning opportunities, and I know that sometimes they can be costly, but I think it's when you learn from those mistakes, it's obviously the important point there. This point about the complexity of soil, that does mean that there are a lot of ways to go about things. There's many roads to Rome, you know, and therefore there's a lot of kind of those different kind of challenges or different things that can go wrong along that. And I think that that's kind of, you know, again, that overlaps to the early question. That's why I would always kind of promote a more slow and steady transition as compared to a cold turkey deep dive. But then again, you know, I do know that some farmers have had a good results with a cold turkey approach. And then I think that probably the main maybe mistake that comes up a bit, and that overlaps also to our early discussion, would be sometimes maybe reducing inputs a bit too fast before the soil was really ready, before it had the capacity to provide that function of nutrient cycling and nutrient delivery, that some farmers might go a little too fast with those reductions and then have a yield impact. But I say that as a common mistake, but I'll also say that I also encourage farmers to go more extreme like that and really cut inputs down really significantly, but only on a single tram line. So it's also an intentional recommendation to say, well, let's see what your soil can, how it's functioning. Let's dial those inputs, really almost a cold turkey type approach, but we're only going to do that in a small area, and we're going to observe that, and we're going to learn from that. And that's going to help then steer the decision of, okay, well, where is my soil at, and what is a safe or more comfortable reduction in inputs that's not going to be negative, yeah, have a negative yield response. So I think that's probably maybe another one as well.
Yeah, it seems like with many things in life, there's many, many, many things that could go wrong. But if you're starting small, adopting a sort of trial, observe, adapt type of approach, then even if the things go wrong, they're small in the overall scale of the enterprise, and so they're not disasters. They're intentional opportunity to learn and improve. At Soils for Life, we're I think often being asked about the evidence base for some of the practices and approaches associated with regenerative approaches to agriculture. I guess this is obviously a very huge area of discussion and debate, but in the areas that you work, are there things that you feel to be, you know, really well understood by science, and then other areas where there are sort of interesting edges to the scientific research and our understanding?
Sure. You know, through my educational work that I do, I intentionally try to bring a level of scientific discussion. I share papers, I share the evidence, I have all the references on the slides, you know, I put the paper up on the screen, and we talk about what some of the science is suggesting. And I have to be honest that if I look back to my career many years ago, I wasn't quite so sciencey. I was still talking about what I mean by that is I was still talking a lot of the same things, but I wasn't necessarily putting the evidence up on screen to talk about, to demonstrate, to directly show that. And this change over time in my educational work was off the back of the very statement that you make there. I heard it many times in many circles. Oh, where's the evidence for this? Oh, there's really no evidence for some of these ideas. And it was that actually I thought, kept thinking to myself, well, actually there is lots out there. It's just very scattered. It's not all in one perfect place, in one perfect package. And I think that's true of the regenerative discussion. Sure, if you type in regenerative agriculture and you're looking for kind of specifics to that, there may not be as much robust evidence. But if you break regenerative down into, okay, let's use the examples of the soil health principles. Okay, now more specifically, yeah, sure, well, I could bring you a bunch of evidence that supports some of those soil health principles or some of the specific practices that might sit under regenerative agriculture. There's plenty of evidence to support that. It just doesn't necessarily come under the banner or the heading of regenerative agriculture. And so I think that for me, that's kind of in response to that comment, hearing that many times, I started to put more and more science into the discussion and demonstrate and said, okay, this paper doesn't use the word regenerative agriculture in it at all, but it is totally talking about something that is very relevant to that. So for me then, I think that there's probably lots of good things that the science understands well. I think coming back to our example earlier, some parts of the soil chemistry and the soil physics, we could say that they're a lot more understood. We could definitely say that soil biology is less understood. You know, it's definitely that piece of the puzzle that is particularly complex, just because of the sheer diversity of organisms that live in there, the sheer numbers and diversity of organisms. So sure, we could say that that one's a little less well understood. And, you know, and it's great to see that there's so much interest in that topic these days, both from farmers, but also researchers. We are working hard to fill in the blanks in the department there in the world of kind of the soil biology, you know. And I think then another one would be, of course, soil organic matter. I mean, this is just a hugely debated one now, soil carbon sequestration, how much carbon can soils really hold and sequester? And yeah, the jury is very much out on that one. But I think that I'm very interested, I think, to the question of that science that's on the edge. We have this kind of debate about building soil organic matter and the role of root exudates in building that soil organic matter. Traditionally, they were thought that they didn't really make a big contribution, but now we're beginning to understand that they do make a much bigger contribution than maybe we previously thought. So I think that the role of root exudates in building overall soil organic matter is an emerging area that I think is also a very interesting one. That's maybe still a little on the edge, but certainly the evidence base is growing for that one as well.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. I think you mentioned earlier that you know a lot of that evidence base is not necessarily sitting under a heading of regenerative agriculture. And I think that goes for a lot of what we talk about in this field. What do you think it actually means to crop regeneratively? And I guess to add to that, in your wildest dreams, what do you think the regenerative crop farm of the future might look like?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Yeah, some of our grazing friends that might be listening in would probably say, well, there is no such thing as regenerative cropping. And, you know, there's an argument there. It's has a few weaknesses. It's, you know, annual dependent. It's not a perennial system. There are certain things that will be its Achilles heel, certainly, and make it difficult. But nonetheless, look, for me, I think that the cropping, the big kind of, I think, and it's a personal interest of mine, but I think it's also a big opportunity in the cropping space at the moment is that principle around diversity. And I know that that's much harder. So we can do multi-species pastures and cocktail cover crops and go really high diversity in some of these other contexts. But in the cropping phase, it's much more difficult to do kind of polycropping. So I'm very enthused to see things like companion cropping and intercropping emerging. And then the next step from that, also these kind of variety blends using different, for even so it's still a monoculture, but at least we have a range of different varieties in there. So a genetic diversity coming through. So for me, I think that I push that out to envision, okay, that's the one I think where we've got a lot of room for improvement. Is there an opportunity to be growing polycropping and somehow with five crops in it? I mean, is this theoretically going to be possible? Now, yes, we can do it already if we don't need to separate them. If you're just combining it and it's going to be a soup mix or something, or it's just going to be a seed, like, and for animal feeds, that's also one avenue. It doesn't need to be separated for animal feed. So sure, it does exist in that kind of context, in that limited context. But yeah, I'm quite curious to see how far we can take this diversity one, and could we have some really complex polycrops along with variety blends within those polycrops, and then doing that over time through a rotation. But for now, I think we have to accept that cropping has a few weaknesses. You know, annual plants, they have smaller root systems. They're not going to be so able to take care of themselves. They're going to have small root systems. They're going to need a bit of help with some inputs and things like that to help them grow along. So this kind of discussion about trying to at least get some diversity in is great. And I think this discussion about reducing some of those inputs is also great. We have more and more examples emerging now of farmers also producing crops without fungicide or without insecticide. And okay, I'm not going to say they're doing this 100% of the time every single year, but we have plenty of examples where we've seen, okay, it's definitely possible. And I think that that's another area that I'm encouraged. I think it's early stages in some of that discussion, but I know many farmers that have had a great year. They've used zero chemical inputs. And I think that it's clearly possible. Do we have knowledge gaps about that? Of course. Is there a lot of work to do about that? Sure. But I think that that would be another one that I would really like to see in the future, that it's certainly pesticide free. And I think that, again, diversity would really help be a tool to achieve that lower pesticide use as well.
I have heard you mention animal integration before, and some of our predominantly grazing farmers in our network do say, well, you know, that seems obvious, you know, bring animals into the system and you just get an immediate boost. To go to that point about diversity, increasing diversity, that just brings an immediate increase in diversity. Is that like the future of cropping? Do you see animal integration being a big part of that?
Yeah, I would like to. And I know that some cropping farmers just have no interest in animals. And I think that if they are that type of a farmer, it's probably better to not do it rather than to do it badly. So I think that's fair.
Speaking of things that can go wrong.
That's right. So I think that's fair. But I do think that I do think that there's a lot of benefits to livestock in the system. And again, that even overlaps with the discussion about diversity and having some of those polycultures. I think you could, if you're grazing cover crops or grazing polycrops, if that's the end use of them, then that's also too easy then, you know. So I think that, you know, and when I did my MSc research, it was looking at barriers and motivations and barriers to the adoption of intercropping. And I interviewed a selection of farmers here in Canada. And yeah, it was very clear that those farmers that had animal integration, they all commented that how much of an asset it was for them. Particularly just when things kind of maybe go wrong, those learning mistakes that we talked about. So when things can go wrong, the crop will never be wasted. You've always got the opportunity to turn it into fodder, to make the animals, you know, put it to use. So it kind of, in a way, it gave farmers a bit more room for experimentation. I think it created an opportunity for that innovation because they knew they had something to fall back on. It wouldn't be a total waste. So frankly, I do think livestock is really valuable and an important one of those principles. And it should be adopted as best as possible if the farmer's interested.
Brilliant. Well, I think that's a really good place to end the conversation. So thank you so much for coming onto the Soils for Life podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
This episode was hosted by me, Ellie Court, produced by Chris Wiffering, and edited by Michelle Watts. Head to the Soils for Life website to find out more about our Cropping Resilience Project. If you're a cropper, you can find out how to join our cropping discussion groups or apply to receive 2 years free access to the Soil Mentor soil monitoring app. And if you have experience in transitioning to a more regenerative cropping system, we'd love to hear about your experiences to inform our practice guides and help other growers. Please get in touch via info@soilsforlife.org.au. Thanks for listening.